for every possible sound combination. So I would have to have one for ba, ka, da, fa, ga. Then I'd have to have one for bo, ko, do, fo, go, and so on. But I'd have one symbol for each of those sound possibilities. And I could array them, and that's not so bad, but it makes a lot of symbols. What I can do beyond that is alphabetic writing. I can have a certain number of letters from Aleph and Beth in Hebrew, Alpha, Beta in Greek, you see. I can have a certain number of letters, and I can assign each one of them a sound value. And then, of course, what I can do is create all sorts of irregularities to terrorize school children down through the centuries. But that's another story entirely. I can assign sound values to letters so that each letter holds a place of its own and makes its own sound and forms new sound in combination with other letters. The Greeks are going to learn an alphabet in our next lecture. They're actually going to borrow an alphabet from the Phoenicians. But at the moment, they're writing in linear syllabic writing. So, three kinds of writings: pictographs, syllabic writing, alphabetic writing. We've had two. We'll get the alphabetic in our next lecture. All right. What do the Linear B documents tell us? Well, as I said a moment ago, a world of bureaucracy. I'm going to come back to that point a little bit in connection with Homer in a minute, because if you've ever read the Iliad, there's not a lot of bureaucracy in the Iliad. So are things slightly out of step? We'll come back to that. In the second place, archaeology. The second way we know about the Mycenaeans is archaeology. Massive and impressive remains found at the sites of these great cities. Found at Mycenae, found at Pylos, found at Tiryns, found at Corinth, and so on. These people built big palaces. Not big temples, big palaces. Now, remember when we talked about Mesopotamia, we saw that temples might mean the predominance of temple priesthoods, palaces might mean the predominance of kings. Walls and palaces might mean kings and warrior aristocracies. Now, if you've read the Iliad, you have certainly meant powerful warrior kings and powerful warrior aristocracies. That begins to sound a little bit more like, that is to say, the archaeology now begins to sound a little bit more like the world that we actually encounter, you see, in Homer's Iliad. So we have a sense then of powerful rule, of local strong men, of strongly exercised leadership. All right? Now, the next type of source, the next thing that permits us to draw inferences about this Mycenaean world are the Homeric poems. Now, the Homeric poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and as you probably know, there are all sorts of theories about the Iliad and the Odyssey, you know, that they weren't written by Homer, they were written by another guy whose name was Homer, or that they were written by two different guys, and they've been confidently dated to a lot of different moments in a lot of different places and so on. We don't have time here to pursue all of these issues. We'll skate through them rather safely, I think. The Homeric poems, but particularly the Iliad, the poem about Ilion. Ilion is Troy. The Iliad is the great poem about the Trojan War. It's the Mycenaean heroes, Agamemnon and company, going over to fight on the coast of Anatolia, to fight at Ilion, or what we call Troy. They're very controversial poems. They're very controversial sources. Why? First of all, it is clearly a large body of oral material that is circulating in all sorts of different forms over a long period of time. Let me give you one example of this. If you've ever read the Iliad, for example, and you kind of remember the various gods and goddesses and the jobs they have, then you might have read one or another of the Greek plays. And you've encountered those very same gods and goddesses, and they got different jobs. Obviously, the stories of the old days were remembered differently in different places. Round about 800, it appears that the Homeric Iliad, and perhaps the Odyssey as well, began to be put into something like the shape in which we now have them. They began to be kind of assembled as a corpus of material. Probably by about 725 BC or thereabouts, they had begun to achieve almost a kind of canonical status in the growing Greek cities. In other words, now there really was a way that you had to tell this story. People had certain expectations about how the story would be told. By about 550 BC, the poems were written down for the first time. Now, that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because they stabilized. It's a bad thing because it killed a living tradition, froze it, never to grow anymore. But our problem as historians is to say, how on earth do we use a poetic corpus built as it were, between 800-ish and 550-ish BC to tell us about a world that played itself out between 1400 and 1200. That's the puzzle. How do we use the Homeric poems? Now, the poems purport to tell us about the old days, to tell us about those people. So, the problem is, what do they tell us? What can they tell us? Well, for a long time, there was a great deal of skepticism on